marker on this board. Let me tell you about Hiram Edson's articles. How many, Duane, you know how many articles he wrote? Okay. There was a series of articles that Hiram Edson started dealing with the scattering and gathering and the 2520-year prophecy of Leviticus 26. James White asked him to write these articles to help put some material in the Review and Herald magazine. And even in the beginning of the article, Hiram Edson says, you know, I haven't got all these things thought through. And he was at that time busy trying to, build up a farm because he had put everything he had into the Millerite movement and he was trying to get back on his feet. So you could tell, circumstances, you could tell that he probably didn't have 100% of his time to focus on those articles. So maybe that's why they never got concluded. No one seems to know, and friends that have looked at these articles have tried to find out why the articles were never finished. You know, they've talked to Ellen White and State and people like that. Perhaps you should ask Brother Damsteed when you talk to him again. He might be some... He didn't know either. Okay. So, these articles became of interest to some of us because one of Hiram Edson's points is that during the time period of the 2520 years, which biblically is identified as the scattering, he makes a strong and thorough case that at the that scattering time comes to a conclusion in 1798, and then Bible prophecy says that the Lord was going to gather his people together. But not only that, Bible prophecy identifies the place where he was going to gather his people together, and Hiram Edson shows that it is the United States of America from Bible prophecy. So that's interesting in itself, but in the material we present, if you were here this weekend, we have pointed out that the argument that gets raised against what we're sharing more than any other is that the glorious land in verse 41 is the United States. That's what we believe. So those of us that have been dealing with these things, when we found these articles by Hiram Edson, we've seen that Hiram Edson says that the glorious land of verse 41 of Daniel 11 is the United States. So it's not a pioneer position. You cannot say that's a pioneer position, but you can see a pioneer that was coming to that conclusion for different reasons. He wasn't trying to give an analysis of the last six verses of Daniel 11. He was trying to show the role of the United States as being the place where God gathered his people together after the scattering. But nevertheless, his logic is sound. So these articles are very nice, but he's had some problems in them, okay? So recently, I decided, the way it's written, you can see his writing, he has a request in there that because these ideas aren't completely thought through, that if anyone wants to respond to his articles, to feel free to do so. It's kind of like, if you want to get involved with, you know, working through this information, go ahead. Well, to take a look at. So it doesn't seem as if anyone ever responded to his request, but I decided to do so. So I'm in the process of writing a little book where I am going to put his seven articles into this book and try. But it's, for me, it's a work in the sense that I have to be very, very clear and simple about why I agree with what he's saying and why I disagree with what he's saying. And some of the things that he's saying about Revelation 17, I think that he's incorrect on because he wasn't at the end of the world. He was still functioning under the fact or under the belief that they were at the end of the world. And some of the arguments that had been developed about what Revelation 17 represented prior to 1843, he was still holding on to. So you have to. I feel like I have to address those if I'm going to send out. If I'm going to write a book, then I want to at least respond to those. But I want to uphold him where I believe he's correct. So this morning, I wanted to print that out for you all. And I went in there, and I've already got a rough draft on a preface and an introduction to the book, explaining some of the things I'm doing, just like I just did now with you. And then I put all the articles into this manuscript, And I started to go through and change where he uses Roman numerals. You know, he has Genesis V for Genesis 5. And if it's Genesis 5:4, he has Genesis V, I, V. So I'm changing all those things and cleaning it up. And also I pulled this off the Pioneer CD-ROM. And when you pull it off as Pioneer CD-ROM and you put it into Microsoft Word where you can write on it, each paragraph has notations from the CD-ROM that you have to cut and paste and get them off there. So I'm in the process. Haven't started really to write on it, okay? But this morning I wanted to get this out to you, and I realized, now do I want to try to go through and clean all these up? And I realized that there's no way. I've done this before. There's no way I would have got it done before late this afternoon at the earliest. And then if I took it to Kinko's, there's no way I would have got it. I thought, nope. I'm going to take it right down to Kinko's, and I did this morning. I took it to Kinko's, and I shrunk it, by the way. It was in 12-point font, and it was 50-some pages, and because it's 7 articles, plus what I've written. And I shrunk the font down where I got it to 30-some pages, and went down to Kinko's, and they said, be done by 4. And then they called me and said, done by 5. And when I went down there at 5, they said, pick it up tomorrow morning. So if you come tomorrow night, we're going to have this for you. And we'll also have a set of rules of Bible prophecy by William Miller. And I took my memory stick. Everyone know what a memory stick is? Okay, that's, you can take your magic stick to take your files off your computer and take them down to Kinko's and say, there's 2 files on here. Please print them out. And I did that. And I left it with them all day, which is fine. And in the meantime, today, I put together the notes that we began going through last night, but when they didn't give me the papers, they didn't give me the memory stick. So I don't know. Tomorrow morning when I go in and pick up these papers, perhaps I can get my memory stick, go back, and get the notes from last night that we were going through, because there were some people that wanted that, and go back to Kinko's and get those printed as well. We're not done with those notes. We still have a few more verses to pick up. As we begin here, what this on the board is illustrating is that Hiram Edson is applying this is 2520 here, the 2520-year prophecy of Leviticus 26. He identifies as starting in 723, which if you have a Bible with Usher's chronology in it, which is the standard of chronology, you'll see in the margin of 2 Kings chapter 17, when verse 5, that the first carrying away of Israel into Syria was 723. And this is the indignation of God against Israel for not keeping the covenant. With this starting point, 1260 years later, which is 3.5 times, brings you to 538. And then 1260 years later, which is 3.5 times, brings you to 1798. Hiram Edson and the Bible are teaching that there are 2 phases of trampling down that take place against Israel. And, of course, the Bible upholds this from other places, too. In Daniel 9:26, which is a verse that's identifying pagan Rome trampling down the sanctuary during AD 70, it says, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. This trampling down, the verse clearly says, is carried on. And then in Revelation 11, verse 2, it says that the papacy, it doesn't say this directly, but it says that the holy city, the Gentiles, will trample down for 1260 years. And the 1260 years lets us know that this is the papacy that's trampling down the city for 1260 years. It's just 1260 years. So one of the reasons that I went to the pattern of Christ last night, we did that study on the pattern of Christ. When we do the study on the pattern of Christ, some of the conclusions on that study that we want to make have very little to do with this. I mean, there's other conclusions in the study of the pattern of Christ that we did not even get close to speaking with you about last night. What I want you to see, that Christ was 30 years in preparation. He's born 30 years of preparation. Then he's empowered when he's baptized. He gives his testimony for 3.5 years. Then he dies, resurrected, ascended. Then in AD 70, shortly thereafter, Jerusalem is destroyed, which is a type of the 7 last plagues time period. And then Sister White says, when Christ came to John in the year 100 to give him the vision of the revelation, that that was a type of second coming of Christ. So all these waymarks are in the pattern of Christ. 30 years preparation, empowerment, death, resurrection, ascension, fall of Babylon, second coming of Christ. And there are other passages in sacred history or in prophecy, however you want to articulate it, that are dealing with Christ, where you see that this same pattern is carried out. Adventism, starting in the Millerite time period until the 144,000, is a type of Christ. Adventism, the purpose of Adventism is to be raised up to perfectly reflect the character of Christ. And you can mark these identical waymarks in the history of Adventism. Moses, you can go into the time period of Egypt. You can mark these identical waymarks in that story. But the Antichrist, anti meaning in place of, the power that stands in place of Christ, walks through this very same pattern. Particularly if you uphold the pioneer understanding of the book of Daniel, which is that in 508, paganism had been removed from the empire in order to finish the work of placing the papacy on the throne of the earth. So you have 30 years of preparation, and this would be a starting point for the 1290-year time prophecy of Daniel 12:11. And if you remember that this pattern of the Antichrist, 30 years of preparation, then empowerment, then he gave his testimony for 3.5 prophetic years, then received the deadly wound in 1798. The next focus of Bible prophecy is the healing of the deadly wound, the resurrection of the papacy, the ascension of the papacy to the throne of the earth, and then the papacy falls fully and completely during the seven last plagues time period and Christ come. This identical pattern is carried out. Very easy to see, by the way, that this is the same pattern by the Antichrist. But in the time period when Christ was establishing this pattern, one of the things that is being carried out in that history is the Old Covenant, the earthly sanctuary is being set aside for the heavenly sanctuary, literal human priest being set aside for our high priest that goes into the heavenly sanctuary. So there's a change in dispensation in this pattern of Christ, and there's a change of dispensation in the story of Rome. It's in the same history, right at the same point where Christ is ushering in a new and better way in terms of his religion, that in this prophetic history of the papacy, you're seeing the transition from pagan to papal Rome. One dispensation being replaced with another dispensation. So this pattern here in 508 also has a time prophecy that comes out to 1843. Now, what's this down here? Of course, this is the 2300-day prophecy. What is this down here? When you get to Hiram Edson's article, and this is something to pick up on in his article, Hiram Edson is saying that in Daniel 8:13, when it says, "And I saw one saint, I heard one saint saying unto another saint, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to tread down the sanctuary and the host." Bad paraphrase. But in verse 13, the question is asked. In verse 14, we know the answer is the foundation of Adventism. Unto 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed or justified. But in that question of verse 13, Hiram Edson is saying, the question is more asking how about the trampling down, about this 2,520-year trampling down of the sanctuary. And he's suggesting that, yes, the 2,300-day prophecy is directly connected to that question, but the best answer for the conclusion of that in verse 17 or 18 of Daniel 8, I better look or I'll really get chastised by those people that might listen to this on a tape. Verse 19 of Daniel 8, Gabriel comes to Daniel and he says, and he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time of the point of the end shall be. Gabriel's come to give Daniel information after verses 13 and 14 of Daniel 8. After the question about how long and after the answer of unto 2300 days. And higher medicine say, the same, that what Gabriel's coming to make Daniel understand is about the end of this 2520 years, the end of the indignation. And he makes a case for it. He makes a case for it that the question of verse 13 is about this scattering time, this indignation time, but at the same time, and this isn't really that hard, I'm about done too, follow me, at the same time, he's not denying that the 2300 day prophecy is directly connected with this 2500 day and 20 year prophecy. And his argument is this, is that the pattern for this understanding is in the story of Egypt. This is how long was Israel captive in Egypt? 400 years? Or 430? But anyway, there's a time prophecy when Israel was captive in Egypt, and he's suggesting that this pattern of Egypt is the pattern of the 2520 and of the 2300, because after the time prophecy, when they came out of Egypt right here on the selfsame day, what did they then do? They went out and raised up the sanctuary. So he's saying this 2500 day prophecy, 2520, is paralleling the time period that Israel was captive in Egypt, and of course, the trampling down of Israel during the 2520 is a type of the being in bondage to Egypt that Sister White uses, okay? Okay, famine in Joseph's day. They go down into Egypt, and they're in captivity for 400 years, and then God brings them out, and they raise up the sanctuary. And so he's saying the 2520 is a type of this bondage in Egypt, and the 2300 years that brings us to the raising up of the sanctuary one more time is paralleling this. So you see his logic? That's his logic. Pardon me? 43. Yes. Now, before I go to the 1843, let me ask a question to try to make a point. When was the first disappointment? You know, there was the first disappointment in the Millerite time period, right? Ah, okay. See, normally we answer the first disappointment is in 1843. And that's correct. If you say the first disappointment was in 1843, that's correct. But if you want to go back into the history, that's technically not correct in the sense that they were operating off, the Millerites were operating off, first off the Mosaic chronology, and then towards the end, I think they accepted the Karaite chronology. Karaite. But the point is this, according to the Karaite chronology that they were using by the time 1843 came along, they believed that the year they were looking for began in March of 1843 and it ended in March of 1844. So when we talk about the first disappointment, they may have been disappointed in March of 1843, but they held their breath until March of 1844. And when March of 1844 passed, they were disappointed. So to say that the first disappointment in 1843 is correct, no problem. But in reality, it even took in part of 1844. So, March 21. So, with that being understood, In 508, you have a 1,335-year prophecy that begins. And at this point, I haven't, and there may be several for all I know, but at this point I've never found a pioneer that addresses what I'm going to share with you. Some of the pioneers, when they corrected the date to 1844 for the 2300-day prophecy, some of them just moved the 1335 right into 1844 as well. They just automatically, like the 1335 was 1844. But the math in my mind is 1843. And there are statements where Sister White says, "Blessed is he who cometh. Blessed are the eyes that saw those things that transpired in 1843. And I'll give you that quote tomorrow. I've put it on this other printout. So what the 1843 is, what I'm saying here, is the 1335 day prophecy. And I'm saying that it ended in 1843, where the 2300-year prophecy ended in 1844. And, of course, the pioneers on this chart have the 1335-day prophecy ended in 1843. And I don't know what their logic is for those of them that, after they moved the 2300-day prophecy to 1844, I don't know what their justification was for moving this 1335 to 1844. Some of them did it. I don't know that all of them did. I think it's 1843. But there may be an argument to be made that the historical point in 508, where King Arthur was the last king that surrendered to the papacy in 508, did it in December or something, and maybe the starting point could be understood to push to 1844. I don't know. Any other questions on that before we move on? It ended in 1843. Started in 508.
What differs from that then?
What differs from what?
You said that you differ from that.
This is how the pioneers understood it. Okay, right here. Although the pioneers understood that, at this point of this chart, they were still understanding that the 2300 days came to a conclusion in 1843. This is the 1843 chart. After the disappointment, on March 21st, 1844, after they knew that it was not going to happen in 1843, they recalculated, and there's a whole history that we should understand on how they got to their conclusion of October 22nd, 1844. After this time period, this chart, they changed their understanding of the 2300 days correctly to October 22nd, 1844. But this time prophecy is different than this 1335 prophecy. Okay? It's different. They had calculated it concluded in 1843. After the great disappointment, I don't know what happened. I don't know why they didn't rethink, go back in and dive into the 2520 and relook at the 1335, and some of them did, but you know, they were doing other things. Okay, that's noted. But so what I'm saying is, some of these.
So you're saying the 1335 was never recalculated.
Right, but I'm also saying, though they never recalculated it, that some of the pioneers, when they wrote about it later, instead of saying it came to a conclusion in 1843, they said it came to a conclusion in 1844. But I've never seen their reasoning for doing that.
No justification.
It was just like you moved the 2300-day prophecy to 1844, so you automatically moved the 1335 to 1844. I don't know why.
Samuel Snow. He's the one that first came to October 22.
Yes. And that would be worthwhile going through that process. If we haven't done it recently. So let me finish up the thought last night and begin through these notes that we've handed out the night before last. We ended in Ezekiel, I believe. Ezekiel, first one to remember, let me know. Ezekiel 11, okay. Verses 17 through 21. We'll start there. Before we read those verses, here's a brief summation of what I was suggesting last night. More than brief. Ezekiel 11, verses 17 through 21. Ezekiel 11, verses 17 through 21. Earlier in our meetings, Friday night, Saturday night, we have pointed out, Friday night, Sabbath, Sunday, we pointed out that Revelation 10, verse 1, begins in 1840. The angel that comes down, Sister White says, is Christ, and that he came down in 1840, and that is the first angel's message. Came into history on August 11, 1840, with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. At that point, Sister White, the historians say the message went to every country on the globe, and that's why when Christ came down in Revelation 10, his foot was on the land and the sea. Now, there's going to be another movement of Christ, a manifestation of the Holy Spirit in this history, and that was the midnight cry in August of 1844. But you do not see Sister White saying that in the midnight cry, the message went to the whole world. The midnight cry, if you look closely, it's talking about how that message swept across North America. But when Christ came down in 1840, that message went all over the world. And that was the beginning point of Revelation 10. And when he came down, he has a little book open in his hand, which Sister White straightly tells us is the book of Daniel. And it's symbolizing that at this point in time, the book of Daniel is empowered. And it was. It was empowered because with the fulfillment of the time prophecy found in Revelation 9:15, 391 years, 15 days, then the Ottoman Empire is going to collapse. When it happened right on time on August 11, 1840, the world that was watching realized that what the pioneers had been saying about the other time prophecies using the year-day principle, that it was going to happen too. So suddenly, 1843, the return of the Lord was much more serious. That's what empowered the message. The book of Daniel was empowered by a prophecy in the trumpets of Revelation. This history proceeds, and in the midst of this history, in verse 7, you have the identification that the seventh angel begins to sound. And the seventh angel is the seventh of seven angels that begin sounding in chapters 8 and 9 in Revelation. And the pioneers correctly identify that these seven trumpets are the historical forces that bring down Rome. The first four trumpets bring down Western Rome. By 476, the Romans were no longer in control of the city of Rome. That's Western Rome. And the glory of Rome, both West and East, but primarily the glory of Western Rome was the city of Rome. So once those barbarian forces had taken control of the city of Rome by 476, Western Rome was gone. That's the first four trumpets. The next two trumpets, when Islam comes into history, the fifth trumpet, the first woe, the time period of Muhammad, and then the next trumpet, Islam, the time period of the Ottoman Empire. During those two trumpets, Eastern Rome comes to its conclusion. And the forces that brought Eastern Rome down were the armies of Islam. So once you get to the sixth trumpet, the second woe, you see the time prophecy saying, identifying when the Ottoman Empire is going to collapse, when this power of the sixth trumpet is going to come to its end. So before the story of the trumpets goes any further, we have introduced into the scenario in chapter 10 the impact that this prophecy in the sixth trumpet had on the Millerite movement. This is where Jesus comes down and empowers the Millerite movement. And then once this history begins to flow, it says that in verse 7 that the seventh trumpet begins to sound. And the seventh trumpet begins to sound, the pioneers correctly understood, on October 22nd, 1844. And the time period of the seventh trumpet is the time period of the investigative judgment It's the time period of the antitypical Day of Atonement, October 22nd, 1844. That's how the pioneers understood it. But usually we miss that the emphasis on this verse about the mystery of godliness being completed during the investigative judgment, it's emphasizing the finishing of that work. We take too shallow a view of what the mystery of godliness is, and we think it's strictly Christ in you, the hope of glory, but the reality of it is, as the testimony of all the prophets was, that at the end of the world, God was going to gather a group of people together that would glorify His name, the 144,000. And there would be a series of prophetic issues that contribute to the development of this 144,000. But one of them that I hope you will see here before we go further is that when you get to the end of chapter 10 of Revelation, you see the disappointment illustrated when John eats the little book, sweet in his mouth, bitter in his stomach, and then in verse 11, it says you must prophesy again. The history that's specifically identified in chapter 10 of Revelation, it begins in 1840 and it ends in 1844. It begins with a fulfillment of prophecy in the sixth trumpet, and it continues to the point in time when the seventh trumpet begins to sound. That's the history that's being dealt with. And then when you get to verse 4, where the seven thunders sound, and John's told to seal up what the seven thunders thundered, Sister White says that those seven thunders symbolize the history of 1840 to 44. She's being consistent to the chapter where verse 4 is found. Chapter 10 of Revelation is telling the history of 1840 to 44, and Sister White says the seven trumpets is simply the history of chapter 10 of Revelation. But then she goes on further and says it's also a history of events that take place at the end of the world. And we've read those quotes. We've talked about them much. So what I'm suggesting here is that the chapter 10 is talking about, one of the things it's talking about is the beginning of Adventism, when the seventh trumpet begins to sound, and the end of Adventism, when it's finished sounding. And the end of Adventism, when the 144,000 are developed, is illustrated by the beginning of Adventism, when the Millerite movement is raised up to establish God's denominated people. And I'm saying God's denominated people on purpose, because God established His denominated people on October 22nd, 1844, when He moved into the most holy place. And the end of Adventism is illustrated from the beginning of Adventism. And in both instances, there's a gathering that takes place. The gathering is what Hiram Edson spent time to talk about, that during this 2,520-year time prophecy, God's people are scattered. But when it comes to 1844, it's the gathering time. And that's what Sister White says in early writings. I mean, she says it more than one place, but in early writings, page 74, where she says that the pioneers were correct. Those that gave the judgment hour cry were correct on their understanding of the judgment. Have you read that recently? Because if you have, you'd remember that I think the name of the title of the chapter is the gathering and the scattering. Let me read it to you so you follow what I mean. September, this is early writings, page 74. I got two paragraphs from this page here. And one that we've read, that we've been focusing on is halfway through the first paragraph or so, and it says, I have seen that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord, and that it should not be altered, that the figures were as He wanted them, and that His hand was over and hid a mistake in some of the figures so that none could see it until His hand was removed. Then I saw in relation to the daily that the word sacrifice was supplied by human wisdom, that we've been dealing with that quote, but notice how she leads into this. September 23rd, the Lord showed me that He had stretched out His hand the second time to recover the remnant of His people. and that efforts must be redoubled in this gathering time. In the scattering, Israel was smitten and torn, but now in the gathering time, God will heal and bind up His people. In the scattering, efforts made to spread the truth had but little effect, accomplished but little or nothing. But in the gathering, when God has set His hand to gather His people, efforts to spread the truth will have their designed effect. All should be united and zealous in the work. I saw that it was wrong for any to refer to the scattering for examples to govern us now in the gathering, for if God should do no more for us now than He did then, Israel would never be gathered. I have seen that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord. My point is this. The gathering time commences after the scattering. The scattering comes to its end in 1798. Then God is gathering together a people just like Egypt. The time prophecy of bondage is finished. They're brought out in the wilderness so they can raise up the sanctuary. After the dark ages of the papacy, God is gathering the people together to raise up the sanctuary. There's a gathering that is taking place at the beginning of Adventism, and brothers and sisters, there's a gathering that takes place at the end of Adventism. It's different, but it's still a gathering. Because we are in the Laodicean condition. And at the end of time, when the Lord is going to put together those that make up the 144,000, He's going to awaken those in Laodicea that will respond to His call and gather them together and make up His jewel. So there's a parallel history at the beginning of Adventism and at the end of Adventism that is illustrated in Revelation chapter 10, because what brought the power into the Millerite movement in that time period that is illustrated in Revelation chapter 10 is an understanding from the book of Daniel. Increase of knowledge that prepared God's people to stand. This increase of knowledge is what the Millerites gathered around. At the end of the world, there's going to be an increase of knowledge from the book of Daniel that once again, God's people will gather around. And this increase of knowledge has to do with the Sunday law. Why do they gather around that? Because the Sunday law is the issue that the Lord uses to purify His people. And what I'm suggesting to you is if you look at the phrase in verse 10 of Revelation, in verse 7 of Revelation 10, where it says, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. If you take this phrase, through his servants the prophets, and you run it through God's word, you'll see a theme that is built upon what was the subject that all the servants, the prophets, spoke about. And they spoke about the scattering and the gathering. They speak about the development of a group of people at the end of time that perfectly reflect the character of God. But they also talk about that those people are gathered out of a church that is in apostasy. And the prophets identify that the rebels in that church are removed, and the prophets of the Bible also identify that the rebels are removed from the camp before those people go out and gather others to them. That whole scenario is in the Old Testament. It's not simply in the writings of Ellen White. So that's summation of the reason that we're going through this study. We began to look at some of those themes last night. We left off in Ezekiel 11, verses 17 through 21, which says, Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, I will either even gather you from the people and assemble you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And they shall come thither, and they shall take away all the detestable things thereof and the abominations thereof from thence. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart out of their flesh, and I will give them and heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep mine ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. But as for them whose heart walketh after the heart of their detestable things and their abominations, I will recompense their way upon their own head, saith the Lord God. Look at Amos 9:9-12. Amos 9:9-12 says, "For lo, I will command, and I will sift the house of Israel among the nations, like as corn is sifted in a sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth. And the sinners of my people shall die by the sword, which say, the evil shall not overtake or prevent us. In that day I will raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess." Now notice. Notice the sequence here. There's other places that it's in it. In verse 10, he's going to kill the sinners of the people. Then he's going to raise up the tabernacles of David in order that, in verse 12, that they may possess the remnant of Edom. And Edom is Esau. And when Edom is used, such as here, it's representing mankind. That they may possess the remnant of Edom and all of the heathen which are called by my name, saith the Lord that doeth this. The process that all the prophets spoke about is that when God purifies his church, once it's purified, they go out and bring others to themselves. Look at Ezekiel 20, verses 34 through 38. Ezekiel 4, "And I will bring you out from the people, and gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered, with a mighty hand, and with an outstretched arm, and with fury poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt, so will I plead with you, saith the Lord God. I will cause you to pass under the rod," which is a symbol of judgment, "and I will bring you into the bond of covenant. And I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the country where they sojourn, and they shall not enter into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God." So I would submit to you that when we're speaking about the Sunday law in the United States in Daniel 11:41, identifying it as such, and identifying also that probation closes for Adventism at that point, this is consistent with the testimony of all of Scripture. There comes a point in time when God purifies His church and He removes the tares out, retaining the gold. And the clear illustration of that Seventh-day Adventists should understand is the Sunday law, where we receive either the mark of the beast or the seal of God. So to think that there's a passage in the book of Daniel that is forewarning us that there's about to be a Sunday law where this takes place is consistent with a repetition of history in Revelation chapter 10. Like Brother Duane pointed out, you may not be familiar with it, but if you go back into the pioneers, when they were telling the world that the Ottoman Empire was going to collapse on August 11th, 1840, do you know what else they were saying? They were wrong, but you know what they were saying? That when the Ottoman Empire collapsed on August 11, 1840, probation closes. That's what they were saying. So that was the message that brought the power in back then. So the fact that we're talking about a message here that also has accompanied with it the fact that probation is going to close is very similar. One moment. Talk about taking hold of the covenant. Select the Messages, Book 3, page 385. "The great issue near at hand will weed out those whom God has not appointed, and He will have a pure, true, sanctified ministry prepared for the latter rain." The great issue near at hand will weed out those whom God has not appointed, and He will have a pure and true, sanctified ministry prepared for the latter rain. When's the latter rain come? Sunday law. Why? Because Sunday law purifies the church. Those of us that prepared a character for the seal of God receive the seal of God. Those that have of us that prepared a character for the mark of the beast receive the mark of the beast. Sunday law purifies the church. The latter rain is poured out. But what's the latter rain empowers to do? Witnessing, and it gives us power to stand during the time of trouble. But the point is this. God purifies His church before He brings others in. And that's what the Bible prophecy is teaching. And that's part of the mystery of godliness that is finished in Revelation 10:7. That's part of the story that we haven't been looking at too closely as Seventh-day Adventists. Is that first, the church is purified, and then they're used by the Lord to bring God's other children out of Babylon. And this isn't a theory by Jeff Pippinger. This is in the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, and it's crystal clear, and we need to understand it. We need to understand it because this is what brings what takes place at the Sunday law into clear focus, which we need to understand because it's about to happen. Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14, verses 1 and 2. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land, and the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. You see something going on there? The Lord is going to choose Jerusalem once more, and then strangers are going to join with them. And the people shall take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids, and they shall take them captives, whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors. Brothers and sisters, Adventism was captives of Babylon for 2,520 years. And God's people are going to take captives out of Babylon during the loud cry message. And this terminology isn't speaking about bringing slaves down to the feet of the 144,000. This time period of the loud cry uses warfare terminology in a symbolic way. It doesn't use it in a literal way like people like Shepherd Rods make it sound. This is talking about the response of those of God's other children in Babylon coming and standing with God's people at the end of time. But it takes place after God's church is purified. So, let's go through these notes we handed out a couple nights ago. Yes. They're right there. Does someone need, the title is All the Prophets. Who doesn't have those notes? I'll hand them out, then we'll have a prayer and we'll take a brief break.